Clubhouse.
This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Third Day Podcast. Tonight we're talking about the series finale of the Third Day. This episode was not called Wednesday like it should have been. It was called Last Day, The Dark. It was written by Dennis Kelly and directed by Philippa Lothorp, like all three of these back episodes were. Oh man, it's all over, and a lot happened in this 1 hour and 1 minute episode. What did you guys think?
It was a lot. This was the first episode where I finished it and immediately was like, I'm going to need to watch that again. Like, just replay right away. I needed to see everything at least twice, maybe even more, to just process everything.
I liked it. I liked it a lot. One of the things that drew me to the series in the first place, when we were still sort of on the fence about covering it, was that some intangible part of it reminded me of The Leftovers, which is something that I really liked and would turn on any episode, any time, and just be right back in it. One of those things that came true in this episode that kept that going for me was something that The Leftovers showrunner, Damon Lindelof, said at various points in time when the show was kind of leaning toward a supernatural type explanation. He would counter and say, I could see why you would say that, but that doesn't mean that that's the only way that that can happen. And then they show in other times in the show, they show what that explanation could be. And that's the kind of stuff we got in this episode, that we've been led down a supernatural type path. And then they make the argument for very rational, earthborn explanations for a lot of the things that seemed kind of magical leading up till now. So then it's left up to the viewer to decide how they want to view the show. Do they want to see it along supernatural lines, or do they want to see it? Nope, it's really quite rational what was happening here, and the other stuff is just explained by madness. I like that about this kind of show, that it is gray and you can have an ongoing conversation about it.
I think it very much follows what you said in the very first episode, which was all the double talk. You could take every single thing that someone said two ways. I think that you could take the entire series the same way. It could all be explained very reasonably, or it could all be hocus pocus.
Right.
It's Halloween, so I feel like I'd say hocus pocus a lot.
Oh man, and I think that's a good way to understand the show, and I think it's a good way of framing in the end Helen and Sam. You know, you have Sam who is just, you know, all in on the island. By the end of this episode, well, actually by the beginning of this episode, I mean, he's, you know, doing the party line about OC is important and so OC is amazing and, you know, very much into the magical, mystical element of it. And you have Helen kind of just poking holes, like the friend you take to a magic show who tells you how it's all done as it's happening. You know, just a very analytical, not supernatural, everything has an explanation kind of point of view on it. So it's an interesting way that I think you're right. You can take the show in either way or a combination of both. And I think those two characters kind of frame that point of view, which is nice to see on screen.
If you look at the way that they did the wardrobe for both Sam and Helen, they were basically both wearing white with a vest, but her vest was on the outside, his vest was inside. Two versions of the same thing. And it was interesting because if you guys remember, the rest of the cast was almost always wearing like gray, dark colors. That's why those orange sneakers were so weird. And yet these two were both dressed in white. And even their complexions being like white skin, black skin, you know, really drew that same kind of feel of like, you know, two different ways to look at something.
Just a little shout out. We saw the orange sneakers this episode because we got a couple of like full body Sam shots when they pulled the camera out of it. And they were looking a little worse for wear, looking a little bit dirty.
but they
weren't maintaining the same brightness, but you could still tell they were the same orange sneakers, though. So I like that continuity, you know, 9 months later and he's still wearing them.
Boy, if we get a chance to ever talk to the wardrobe person, I will ask about those orange sneakers as well as the horrible fit of that suit on Jude Law.
Right. Have they been passing down that suit from father to father?
Those pants were so baggy. I mean, it was so gross.
It occurred to me that was Colonel Sanders' suit. Like, they must have, I think they literally took it off of the dead guy's body and gave it to him. Yeah, it was, why is it so fucking dirty? Like, I get, like, maybe you're not doing great hygiene. Are you rolling around in the dirt with fake Nathan?
I think Jess said it best when she was like, take a shower once in a while, like brush your hair. Like, I mean, there's a whole lot going on with Sam that was not about upkeep. I do also want to mention, though, that we had talked about in back to the very first episode, that nickname of Kaz that was between Helen and Sam. And I looked up Kaz. It was intriguing to me from the get-go because my name is Caroline. I don't really think of my name having a nickname. It's a derivation of Charles. I'm just the feminine form. It's really, I don't have a nickname. However, Kaz is a listed nickname for Caroline. I never knew that. I kind of want to be called Kaz now. Like, that's kind of cool. It's like Roz or something. Like, it's all, it's like kind of sassy and weird and wacky. Kind of for it. But here's the deal, guys. It is a Celtic Gaelic descent. It is a descendant of the Vigilant One.
The Vigilant One.
And if you use the Slavic form, it is the famous destroyer of peace. Oh,
that's a little on the nose.
I was like, whoa. So Kaz could have been a little clue in to us had we looked up Kaz way back in episode one, that whomever is named Kaz actually is going to play a very important role. How'd you guys like that?
That's good research.
Very good research. Still doesn't connect why he calls her that, though. Unless her middle name is Caroline or the Destroyer of Peace.
Well, but maybe it was just like a little nod, like Mimir nod. Like maybe it was just like a little something something.
No, and absolutely. And I always liked the fact that it didn't make sense, an obvious sense, because couples, you know, have nicknames for each other. You know, your name is, you know, Joey, but your spouse calls you, you know,
Pickle.
Pickle or like, you know, Timmy. For whatever reason, it's like a joke from 10 years ago when you were dating or something like that. You know, that's like an in-joke that couples have that is not obvious to the outside world. And I like that because it makes them feel lived in. It makes them feel like they had a life before the cameras began rolling. And, well, maybe they don't have a life together after the cameras are finished rolling, but
It felt realistic. It felt
real. It makes the characters feel like they have existed prior to the show.
I did do a lot of looking. Like, I looked up, like, British pet names or British, like, girlfriend names type of thing. Like Bay or Honey or something.
Poppet.
I didn't find Poppet. I did not find Kaz as like just like a generic term of endearment kind of thing. So, you know, somebody else maybe does better research than I did, but I did appreciate that Kaz was a Celtic nickname. You know, they didn't ever kind of say to us early on that he was of Celt descent, but everything about this island isn't so, since he's a descendant, like I think it's kind of interesting that he would have used that name.
I would love to. I mean, if I had thought of this, I would have done the research. I wonder if, like, one of Jack the Ripper's, like, alleged victims, because there's a core five of Jack the Ripper's victims, I wonder if any of them were named Kaz or Caroline or some kind of derivation of that. Like, something sick. Like, he picked this nickname for his wife and didn't even realize the connection. But there are a bunch of people that I know for sure listen to this podcast every week in Britain, in England. So if you guys have any information for us, please send it to us.
Here you go. Victims were Mary Jane Kelly, Mary Ann Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Martha Tubberham, Francis Coles, Alice McKenzie, Emma Elizabeth Smith.
All right. So no Kaz among the group.
Not that I read, but who knows? Maybe there's more.
The best place to start is kind of at the very beginning of the episode, because there's a lot of Jess to talk about, I think, in this episode for sure. Jess and a lot of Ellie. But I think we need to start with Sam, right? Because like Helen says, this is all about Sam at the end of the day. Or in a lot of ways, it's about Sam at the end of the day. I want to give us a pat on the back for calling him out as being a potentially unreliable narrator. We've been doing that almost since the very beginning. This episode really, really hit the nail on it. It really formed fully how unreliable a narrator he really is. What did you guys think of all the evidence that kind of came out in Helen's rants to him about the real life of Sam that we had no idea about?
It was illuminating. The way that he had crafted his backstory made it sound to me like that the situation with Nathan had kind of broken him and that he had had a short spell of these psychosis episodes. That doesn't sound like the case. It sounds more like he was off more than he was on for a long time. And the icing on that cake was, given that story about how he had been called away to talk to some figure that we thought was associated with the island, and that's why he was distracted when Nathan went missing, and then it finds out it's actually some floozy that had caught his attention, and that was the real reason he was on the phone. That was enough to let us know, I think. There's a lot of reasons to question everything that we've learned through Sam's narrative point of view.
Yeah, and I loved Helen because you could really feel her pain. The 23 minutes and 17 seconds, and she repeats it a couple times. And I like the fact that she blames him. You know, it's one of those things you always hear, you know, like, oh, no one's really to blame. It's just a horrible thing. And Helen's like, nah, bitch, nah, Sam is to blame. Like, my son is gone, and it's your fault. Like, she knows exactly, you know, who's to blame for Nathan's disappearance and death. And I thought that was interesting because that's not usually how you see that play out. So I actually really appreciated that. I really liked how she came at him.
With the facts that were provided, would you guys say that it was the person's fault who was on the phone specifically given that he was talking to another woman?
Yeah. where's the pass there? Where's the, well, here are these extenuating circumstances that make that okay.
Well, kind of like what Mike was just saying, that like sometimes you could just be like, you know, a child got snatched, a child got stolen, right? So people use that type of verbiage versus it is his fault he lost the child. Like those two different kind of POVs.
I think you go to court with that, you lose every time.
There is a line, and I don't know exactly where it is. I think it's probably a shifting line of, I turned my back, and I turned around, and my child was gone. That line is nowhere near 23 minutes, though, of ignoring your six-year-old. Like, that's just gross negligence on every level. I wouldn't want to leave a teenager alone for 23 minutes in that kind of situation necessarily, let alone a six-year-old.
Did you guys see the affair portion coming? Because when the phone call stuff got mentioned, I think that we have thrown out over the course of these episodes that maybe it was Ade he was talking to. Maybe it was the grandfather's friend who didn't show up, that was the person he was calling. I think we threw all those ideas out. Was there any hints along the way looking back that an affair was actually the reason why he wasn't paying attention?
Not to me, but having admitted that, there are several things about the way that Naomi Harris acted that make so much more sense. Like when she learns that Jess is having his baby, and her acting suggests that there's an impact, but only a small one, or one that she is so practiced in handling that she's able to hold her face like 99% still. When you find out, well, actually, he's been having flings and she wasn't really here to save his ass anyway, that even makes it clearer, you know, how she's feeling and how she was able to do that. Just unsolicited opinion on her acting. I mean, Jude Law, he's a known quantity as a great actor, but she might have been the
performance
of the show.
There's a stoicism about her that almost seems odd until it all plays out, and then it all really does make sense. Because, you know, a lot of times, even in this episode, I thought to myself, she's handling all of this very well. But I think part of that is it's because she's not actually here for Sam. She really doesn't really care about what he's doing. She's here for the money. You know, she needs to pick up the pieces of the life of her life that she blames him for destroying, really. Because again, and it's not just the affair, which I think if you look back, maybe there are some signs. I mean, not including the fact that he went to Bone Town with Jess on the first night that they met.
Because he says, I didn't use a condom because I'm married. Like, I was trying to think about all the little nuggets to be like, was there anything else that anything was like thrown in there? Because he was definitely acting like this was the first time he ever
was around anyone.
I was just trying to think about it.
We're all the heroes in our own narrative, right? We're all the ingenues of our own stories. And I think that's how he always presented himself, and I think he largely believes it the same way he believes that fake Nathan is Nathan. He just believes it. He is so, I don't know if delusional is the right word.
Oh yes.
He's so committed to his narrative, whether because it's an actual mental infirmity or just because he is high on his own supply. He believes that he is a good guy who doesn't, like, sleep around. The fact that he says, well, but it was 23 minutes, but I was breaking it off with her. You know, like, the fact that he uses that as an excuse And Helen's like, I don't give a shit. It's not about the fact that you were breaking it off with her. It's because you left our kid alone for, you know, our six-year-old for alone for 23 minutes. But also, we learned about the loans, which were mentioned last week. Loans were mentioned last week, but we had not actually heard really much about that. So it was much more than just him taking the $40,000, stealing the $40,000. It was, on top of that, loans that were taken out fraudulently, it sounds like, with no intent to pay back. It was all really interesting, though. Helen talking about how she wanted to sell and get out, and he wanted to double down and expand. Like, just sounds like a whole, like, parade of horrors.
Okay, but that portion, like, was further explained to the delusional point. The reason why he took the money was because he didn't want her to sell, because if they left, what if Nathan came back and they weren't there?
Well, good, because I did not understand that as an explanation.
Had they had the loan and had everything go the way it was supposed to go, then she was going to sell, get out, be done. He was saying he wanted to double down and make it bigger and everything, right? And when she was like, no, we needed to, like, you know, dissolve this situation, he was like, but what if Nathan came back and then we weren't there? So it was like he couldn't move on. It was the whole conversation that we had that he, if he would move on, things could be right again. But he, when you say double down, he doubled down in this episode of not grieving, of not accepting, of not
right.
moving on.
Just think now back to the very last scene of that first episode where he's like, you know, tripping his, or he's drunk off his ass kind of thing. And he winds up in the trunk of his, in the boot of his car. Sorry, I'll use the Britishism. And
blimey.
And he's crikey, it's a lot of money. And then he's like scrambling up the money. He doesn't actually look very surprised when he's gathering up that money, which I thought was always strange back in the end of that first episode. Considering he spent the entire first episode complaining and accusing, you know, Ade, you know, of stealing the money and really selling it like he believed it. When he's drunk out of his gourd, he scoops up the money, but he's not like, what the fuck? You know, like he's like, oh, here's the money. It was always kind of a weird thing, but of course, he really did know he took it. It's almost like he's a Jekyll and Hyde figure, almost. Depending on the time of the day and the mood he's in and the people he's around, there's like two different versions of Sam that you get.
Oh boy, can we please talk about the theme of Jekyll and Hyde in this? Because I think it speaks to your whole, that again, that larger theme of depends on the way you want to look at it, you know, who you're mm-hmm. talking to right now. Jess, you guys, oh my God. You know, she went from a woman who we felt like we pretty much had a good handle on to like, who is this?
She was really hard to read in this episode, I think. I mean, Paul, I'll kick it over to you. I felt like she was giving off a lot of mixed signals depending on the scene. You know, like, I'm going to kill them all. Or, you know, y'all can stay, but I just don't want to see you. To somewhere in between.
I think her motivations revolve around the independence, the freedom that she feels now. You watched all of or most of Autumn, but as a listener, if you didn't watch Autumn, there are a few key moments with Jess, particularly in the portion that I was assigned, where she calls her husband and basically tells him, I'm staying here and fuck off. And that's kind of like an emboldening that you didn't really see in the first three episodes that speak a little bit more to this new Jess in terms of recognizing a situation for what it is and doing everything she can to seize upon it. I mean, there are multiple points in this episode where I thought she reminded me of Queen Cersei from Game of Thrones, including basically taking the throne at the end, which is how that kind of wound up.
Yeah. That's a good call, for sure. Caroline, what did you think her motivations were? Because I kept wondering, well, she doesn't want anyone to threaten Epona's reign, but yet she's not killing them. I mean, she kills Mrs. Martin. She has a bunch of people executed, but not this family, who is the actual proximate threat to her reign and her daughter's reign.
Lannister always pays her debts.
You know, I think that I need us to talk through this episode before I can try to figure out what Jess's true role ultimately is. The way that she was sitting, you know, in the church and she had on that kind of maroon color and the way that they did her hair, I was getting all kinds of like biblical feel to the whole thing that I couldn't put my finger on, though. I wasn't sure exactly what I was supposed to be understanding.
See, that's where I got that Cersei imagery again. But just the holding court. You don't hold court in church. You do in a palace, you know.
But you're coronated in a church, though. Coronations take place in a church, though.
Touche,
right?
Mike.
my touche is also in church. But when you pick up, you know, the scepter and ball, right, when a new king or queen is crowned in any monarchy, that, you know, takes place in front of God. And so I think that was a very intentional placing there. In my notes and in notes I share with you guys, it felt very Godfather part one, the end, where Michael takes over the family and he's at the christening for Connie's baby and he has all of his enemies eliminated as he's swearing off of the devil and renouncing Satan. He's having all of his enemies
closing all family business.
Yeah, yes, right. He's consolidating the ranks, as it were, right. as he's in church, you know, renouncing Satan. It was a very similar kind of vibe for me. But
let's talk about Cersei, Michael. What I'm saying, this biblical feel to it. Okay, guys, so what are we getting about Jess? It's just the passing of the torch, basically. And we were witnessing some sort of ritualistic, no matter if you're looking at it from Cersei or Michael or the Bible or whatever you're looking at, somehow it's the passing of power.
Oh, I think it was a coup. I think it was a coup d'etat. I don't think it was a passing of power. I think it was a taking
a
of power.
A seizing of power.
It was, it was the rise of the mother, the rise of the matriarchy. Because, I mean, she tells Ellie, she tells, you know, Sam's daughter, like, your dad's been kind of shit. Like, the island gave him a chance, and he ain't done nothing with it. So that's how she's kind of working Ellie, though, right? I mean, she's being blunt, very blunt with her, saying, like, your dad needs to go. You know, take him, get off the island, like, get your mom, like, get all you, like, it's our turn.
This could be season 43, and Epona is still not going to be, quote unquote, ready.
Right, exactly.
Jess isn't going to let it go. I see what you're saying. Okay, so, but let's talk about that.
It's more about the regency, like Cersei and Joffrey, right?
Okay.
Yes.
That totally makes sense to me. So then Jess just represents, you know, a changing of the guard kind of thing, if you will. Like, she's just like the next, anytime there's power anywhere, there's always just going to be like a constant line of people to snatch it up.
And Sam, through his inaction, it sounds like,
right,
created this void.
Well, and he kind of, I mean, we all agreed that once he went inside the house and people had said it once we got into autumn that he hadn't come out in many, many moons, that basically, like, it sounds to us throughout this whole episode that he spiraled into, like, insanity. I mean, much further into insanity.
I think there's evidence that it was insane before. I mean, that Charrington blood is, you know, the family tree and the Charrington bloodline is probably not very robust.
It's potent.
Right? I mean, there's probably some tainted blood there. Jess is the result of his own making. Just from the way she was talking about the fact that she tried to see him and talking about how once he sees the baby, he'll get it. He'll understand how bored she is. I get the impression Jess was looking to rule the island with Sam through their baby.
Okay, so let's talk about this more, because I think you're onto something. I think Helen represents one version of the relationship with Sam. I think that Jess represents some sort of version.
So maybe she's not the Cersei. Maybe she's the Sansa. We just missed all the part where she was treated excessively bad.
And yeah. She was treated excessively. I mean, we know she
was. I know, but
there's
months
bad.
Of it that we didn't see.
No. There was like years of it. She's got the husband from before and all that. Doesn't Sansa have a husband from before? Treated her like shit.
A pretty bad one, yes.
Right.
So, but the idea was that Sansa had this idea of knights and chivalry, and she'll be actually in love with her husband and her husband will love her and they'll raise a family together, you know, and especially once there's a baby, because babies, you know, solve those things. And that's the fairy tale trope for it. And so I think that's right. I think it was Jess committed not to the island, like the phone calls that Paul is talking about. She's committing to Sam. That's why she throws herself on his grave, or the wrong grave. That's why she throws herself on a grave and weeps. You know, she is nesting. She's trying to plan a future where it's her unborn baby and Sam on this island, because his family is out of the picture. The one child he has is gone. as far as she knows. And she's not expecting Helen or the girls to show up to that island. You know, we learn it's Kale that sent that email, not Sam, you know. And so I think Jess had built this entire future of the three of them living this happily, you know, ever after, ruling the, you know, taking care of OC's health going forward. And it just didn't work out that way. Sam wanted, you know, wanted none of it, stayed inside and kind of forced her hand to seize power.
Okay, so now I need to talk to you guys from a, we got to flip the script in a 2020 kind of way, because I don't like that then we basically end up talking about both Helen and Jess only in terms of Sam. Okay, guys, can't we interpret this narrative in a way that these women had their own storylines that didn't have to do with Sam and every little bullshit thing Sam did? Like, did they have their own, did Jess come to the island with anything else going on? Is there any other way to look at it?
I don't think she passes the Bechdel test because she was manipulated there by her husband.
By men, right.
And played into the hand of another man.
Okay. And then it just kept playing, like, every which way. It was just kept playing by other men, right?
Well, no, until she didn't, right? And I think at the end of the day, I think Jess is writing her own storyline.
Yes.
I think she tried for 5/6 of this series to was there because of Sam. And I think this last episode was her saying, you know, fuck you, Jobu, I'll do it myself. I know I use that a lot, but it works in so many situations. Like she says, I mean, she is gonna do it herself. Her and her baby and her as the regent, and she has the island's backing. Like the majority of the island, or at least all of the good players on the island, come to her side. She has, I mean, the most bloodless coup ever, except for it wasn't really bloodless. But it's
Mr. Martin might disagree.
Did we actually watch her pass the Bechdel test then? Did it happen actually in front of our eyes, where she sort of like had her moment and like turned it all around? And it was basically like, yeah, you thought this was about what Helen was to Sam or what Jess was to Sam, but Sam can go brush his hair somewhere elsewhere. He actually doesn't matter. It's about Helen and the girls. It's about Jess and the girls.
I think so. That's interesting that you put it that way, but I could see it that way.
Because at the end of the day, it was Jess standing with all the girls.
Yeah.
With Helen and all the girls. And right. And they basically just said, run along, little boy.
They established a matriarchy, which is what we talked about literally the very first winter episode was, I mean, it was called The Mother. This was, if summer was about the search for a father, autumn was the confirmation of that father. Winter, I think, was about the father hasn't worked out. So now we're going to switch, you know, we're going to switch tracks and we're going to try this matriarchy that Jess is taking for herself.
This father did so bad, he killed it for all the other fathers.
Who's the mother, you guys? We thought Helen was the mother.
Jess is the mother.
Jess end up being the mother?
Yeah.
I think Jess is the mother. Same way that Sam turns to Helen on the dock in his Colonel Sanders outfit and says, I'm the father. You know, Jess is very much now the mother of the island.
Do you think that it could just be like multiple meetings, though? Because, the mother didn't have Jess even in it.
If you wanted to tease the open threads into, you know, sequel series type potential, which I don't, but you can. Ellie.
Well, just season two, right?
Ellie and Ellie particularly. Not, for some reason, Lou doesn't seem to resonate with the island so much, but Ellie was really interested. She said she felt the energy, you know?
Yeah.
So you could argue, again, if you wanted to get all Games of Thronesy on it, you could see where she would want that.
I see Kale being the same type of, like, force to be reckoned with, you know, that there's some, she wants to be, you know, the recognized daughter of the mother of the
queen.
She's
the oldest daughter.
Of the queen, if you will.
Exactly.
And so, like,
that's how that shit works, yo.
There's, like, a lot of really good moments there, little different storylines.
You know, you have to love a story where, like, the females rise up and end up being, like, the really strong ones. And that's what we have here. In the end, you have Kale, who has a definite agenda and a plan, and she carries it out. She carries it out kind of flawlessly from her point of view.
You guys, how much credit do you give that, like, when we heard it was, like, a childish email? I had said it was Nathan who maybe wrote it, But hooray that it was actually Kale. What a freaking shocker.
He was a teenager brought up in like a commune type setting, unable to communicate on an adult level.
Right. Well, I mean, not surprising she has the communication skills of a dead six-year-old, you know. But
he's here all week, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey,
Kale.
Hey, this is not Mike. It's Mike Yale coming at you. I got to tell you, I wasn't against Jess in this episode. Not really. You know, there's a large part of me that kind of like sided with her and Ellie and less so with Helen.
Where did Helen lose you?
I agree with Ellie. I think she's just too fucking cold. I mean, all of that really resonated with me. And I like that she finally turns on her daughter and she's like, who the fuck are you talking to? Like, I have to be Stone because I was keeping all this shit together because Weakling over here, you know, was messing it up for all of us. I appreciate that. And I really like that she, like, put her foot down that way. But I can see from Ellie's point of view, you never talk about Nathan. You never grieve for Nathan. You may call it, you know, she says, you call Dad over the top in it, in his wallowing in it. But you're the complete opposite in the extreme other way.
Surprised how much you guys are kind of anti-Helen because I think she was actually written really genuinely how I think many adult women would handle a situation. Like,
I don't disagree.
You know what we were missing? We were missing all the parts where she was supposed to be weak ass. Like, we missed all the parts where she was supposed to fall apart crying.
I didn't say anything that I didn't like her. I mean, she came here to get 40,000 pounds.
Yeah, she did.
She had her life threatened, her daughter's life threatened, basically, essentially.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And she got them out, got herself out, got the 40K out. Mission accomplished.
Dude, I'm Team Helen.
You get to land on the aircraft carrier.
She's freaking amazing.
I think I'm talking more, I think, in the if you have to pick sides, right? If you have to be like Team Helen or Team Jess. I don't think anyone's Team Sam. Sam can kind of go fuck himself. But I like the fact that they're setting up this new monarchy. I like the fact that she, like, you know, like, Jess is an outsider who outsiders are not welcome on OC. And in less than 9 months, almost to the day, like, has completely usurped power. Martin's dead. Sam, you know, emasculated in the big house or in the church with fake Nathan. You know, Helen and her daughters off the island. She consolidates power like a fucking boss. I dig that.
Maybe you don't need to do that. Maybe we don't need to do Team Helen, Team Jess, you know? And I'm even going to push back on that super duper hard because I'm going to say this. Jess can be the strong woman and Helen can be the strong woman. And they're actually not competing in any way to be playing the same role or to be doing the same job in the story. So why can't they just both be amazing? Why can't we both be Team Jess and Helen? Like,
well, I know, and I acknowledge that too, and that's fair to me because I guess if you frame it as Team Helen or Team Jess, it's because you're centering them around Sam. As far as I'm concerned, Sam gets what he deserves in his, you know, being alone with his fake fourth cousin removed, fake Nathan's son, in the church. Like, that is really, I think, all I kind of needed to know, especially when you learn about kind of who he really is in this episode. I don't want to root for that guy. I want that guy to fail every time. And so if Helen gets her girls and gets off the island and pulls a rowboat across the fucking sea,
that's
love
amazing.
That.
Yeah, that was amazing.
You know, cuddling up with the 40K because she thinks it's Nathan's shirt. I love that. I love that final scene. I love how the girls take care of her. I love how they bundle her up and it's just great. But I also like how Jess sees his power so completely.
But I think that's important because wouldn't you guys agree that most of the time that women are pitted against each other in stories like this and you have to be one or the other instead of them being dueling heroines, one saving the island, one saving her family, you know, moving forward in the world. Like, I think they actually both were amazing women. We didn't see either of them as that weak person who we couldn't figure out. They were both clever. They were both smart. They were strong and they stood up for themselves and all of their children. Mm-hmm. I do have a question mark when it comes to like Jess and the original two children, Kale and the unnamed child, other sister. I'm kind of a little confused about what we should all think about that in terms of like the mother. That all gets real dicey for me.
Again, because New Epona represents an actual anchor to the island, whereas Kale and unnamed daughter, who I'm sure does have a name, they represent her husband, who for whatever reason, like, I mean, again, those kids were keeping her tied to her marriage, right? She wanted to leave her husband. She got pregnant with Kale. She wanted to leave again. She got pregnant with the second daughter. You know, this is a fresh start here. She's an Ossian now. She is an Ossian in power now. The same way she explains to Ellie that Helen doesn't even see Ellie because Ellie is a reminder of the time of Nathan. Tallulah was a fresh start because Tallulah doesn't remember Nathan. I think there was a lot of Jess talking about herself in that conversation as it comes to her older daughters and new baby Epona.
I want to be careful about how we describe some of these situations, because when we hear these things like Helen was so cold to Ellie, we watched two full episodes before we ever put that out there. I don't feel Helen was a cold mother. I saw her cuddling her children, protecting her children, talking to them in the car, not in a cold, stony kind of way. She was chatty with them, and she was, I mean, I thought that she was actually a great mom. There was nothing that I saw there besides just putting this idea Ellie's head that she was like this standoffish woman or something.
I think you're overlooking the several conversations that Tallulah and Ellie have amongst themselves about the fact that Tallulah is their mother's favorite. Tallulah can do no wrong, and Tallulah gets away with everything. Think back to that first episode and the beginning of the second episode. Before Kale comes into the picture, Tallulah gets away with everything because she's mom's favorite, and I am not. And mom is taking us to this island for something I haven't liked since I was 7, and I am now 14. Ellie is dad's favorite. Tallulah is mom's favorite, and Ellie is very much aware of that, as is Tallulah. That's like a recurring conversation. Now, I think this is master manipulation on Jess and Kale's part because they're picking up on that fact. I don't think they created that. I think they're just seizing on it, and they're, you know, using it to make that gap between Ellie and Helen wider. But they didn't create that chasm. Ellie already felt that. Whether Helen feels it or not, her kid did, and they manipulated that wide open.
I don't know. I know that that's what they told you, but that's just not what I saw.
It's what Ellie told us, though. I'm not talking about... we just see Jess and Kale, like prying it open further. Think back to every conversation that Ellie has, if it's not about her getting into a fight or being on the island, it was about Tallulah getting away with it and she not. And her being her mother's favorite.
Where did you see Ellie get like punished or something? And Tallulah getting away with all this stuff. I mean, I know they said it.
Do we have to punish our kids for our kids to feel like they don't like us?
You thought that Helen didn't like Ellie? Like, you actually saw that play out on the screen in any way?
But I'm not Ellie, though. Ellie conveyed to us that she felt that way, and that's what matters. I don't think it matters. I don't think it gives a shit what I think. I think it matters what Ellie thinks, and Ellie expressed the fact that she did not feel as loved by her mother as Tallulah, as she felt that Tallulah was loved.
She was somehow primed to hear that stuff from Kale and Jess.
Yeah.
Somehow.
I don't know.
She was ready to hear it.
I think it's all over those episodes, right? I don't think they implanted that in her head.
I don't know. I feel like there's that 13, 14-year-old girl, if you want to talk about just like being primed for like having an issue with your mom or like not getting along well with your mom. I think like, I don't know any 13, 14-year-old girl that isn't all mother. And it's not, you don't have to have lost anyone. Every little sibling, every baby of the family is the favor. Everybody blames their baby sibling as being the favorite. Like, I just don't even think that's it's just cliche.
But Caroline, does that matter?
It does to me in a story interpretation.
Does it matter if it's true or not, if she perceives it that way? If Ellie fully believes that her mother is squashing her religion, right? She's squashing her interest. The one thing she does like and cares about is religion. She learns that she's being lied to by her mother, right? I mean, Helen, in being a mom, gets unfortunately called out and laid bare in front of her daughter because Jess and Kale together tell every single thing to Ellie, and or she finds out that her mom lied. So in the span of 3 days...
Hold up. We have to back up here. We are telling the story as if this is the story of a 13-year-old girl, and it's not. This story is not the story of a 13-year-old girl. Like, we have to back the camera up. Like, Helen is a fully formed character who had her own motivations and had her own reasons for doing things.
Just and did not share them, and did not share them with her daughters.
With children. Adults don't share everything with children. That's not lying.
It's not lying, but it becomes a problem when someone else goes to your kid and says, yeah, by the way,
and
your
so
mom.
Who's a shit in that situation? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Who's a shit in that situation? The mother who chose not to tell of a psychotic father's behavior, or the other adult who uses it to manipulate a child? Who is a shitty human in that circle of people?
The one who exposes it. But you think I'm blaming Helen, though. I'm not blaming Helen. I'm explaining why Ellie feels that way.
I think no explanation needed. I just think that she just is just only taking it from a child's POV, that they exploited, that the adults had their reasons for doing what they were all doing.
Adults always have their reasons for doing what they're doing, but it becomes a problem, though, when you get found out. You know, she's not 9 or 8. You know, she's 14. She's old enough to realize she's been lied to. You add that to being 14. No one likes to be lied to. But then you add that to being a 14-year-old child. Like, that's like the worst fucking thing you can do. And top of already feeling like you're less loved than your little sister, already feeling like you're being, you know, withheld from engaging in studying religion because your mom is so anti-religion. You know, all of these things all come to a bear. And I'm not criticizing Helen for it, but I'm saying it's very easy to see why Ellie feels the way she does from her point of view. But listen, in the end, Ellie chooses her mother. She could have stayed on the island, though. She could have, when Helen said get in the rowboat, she could have said, nah, I'm going to go back. She, you know, that's important. The fact that they all cuddle together and take care of each other in the end, I think at the end is what's important.
In that scene, just before she cuddles, she looks back at the island. And on our second watch, we discussed whether or not that look was to see if anyone was coming after them, or that longing, like, I kind of thought I belonged there, but I'm needed here kind of feeling.
I definitely had that vibe. The a little bit of regret. Like, she's being a good daughter here. I think she's making good choices for her mother and for Tallulah. And I think that's what is going on here. But I think there is a strong pull to that island. You know, in my head canon, that's not the last time Ellie steps foot on OC. Ellie definitely makes her way back to that island. The same way Sam found himself on the island, pulled there by the call of the Charrington blood, I would very much suspect that Ellie does too.
I had to question it. I was like, oh, it feels like it would be natural. Like, once you were, if you're running, it's natural, like, right? Once you get to the spot to, like, peep out the window and see if anyone's coming. Like, so that seemed right. Mm-hmm. But there definitely had that look in her eye that she was, like, really looking at it in a wistful way.
If you watch, like, to me, if I'm on the lookout for guys coming and I've given it, you know, 10, 15 seconds, I'm still looking at the window when my head is ducking down below, right?
Okay.
But she looks down for a second and then ducks down. And that's, to me, what...
That was the moment that
told
me
she
was thinking.
The extra thought.
That makes sense. I mean, we definitely stopped and watched that scene a couple of times because of that, because of the child's shirt turning into the money, you know, the striped shirt and the striped bag and all that. Like, we watched that scene several times. Of, like, all the different, you know, what's cocooning up here? You know, like, what's happening? This felt like a very metamorphosis kind of moment where it was like, things are changing, things are moving, you know, points of views are being solidified in some way. And I'm not quite sure where exactly everyone landed.
I don't know that we're actually done with Jess or with Ellie yet, but because you mentioned it, I want to jump to the blue and white shirt, because this was really super fascinating, and it was another full circle moment for me, because it's the same kind of blue and white shirt that we see Sam send down the river when dog days are over in the very first episode.
Yeah.
We see when she looks back in the boat and she has that vision of real Nathan, not fake Nathan, and he's wearing it for the first time, not looking dirty, but he's wearing that bright blue and white shirt. So the whites are so white, it's almost glowing in the dark, kind of, so clean it is. And then obviously she envisions it, the money turns into the shirt and she cuddles to it like she's like holding on to it. It occurred to me, every time Sam envisioned Nathan. He was dirty and ragged looking with the boots and the dirty shorts and all that. Helen envisions him clean. What does that mean? What does that represent, do you think? That they, is it guilt versus grief? Like Sam has guilt over Nathan, and so his last idea of him is this dirty, destroyed child, and Helen just has grief over the loss of her son, and so envisions him in a clean state?
Are you talking about, when you say that Sam is envisioning him, are you talking about all the times that he was seeing a child run around the island?
Yes.
Okay, aren't we 100% sure that that was a real child who was his little cousin?
No.
Okay, I'm
I think it's
not
some
there.
Of the time, but
because I the same way Helen's like, that's a completely different child altogether. Mm-hmm. I think the child that they had in this episode was much taller than the vision we saw on the island, and including like in the autumn when they walk away together. And I haven't done the screen cap, but I'll probably do it at some point. I want to look at, like, take a screen cap of the size of that child against Jude Law in autumn.
Bigger and
much bigger,
stockier to me,
and wearing different clothes. And I think that was the big tip off that it was a different child.
Yeah, he was wearing like red jogging pants or something.
The one that we saw all through summer and then at the very end of autumn was wearing like the boots, the red shorts, and the dirty like striped horizontal shirt. This mm-hmm. one was wearing like a red like hoodie, and seemed much taller than the other Nathan. So I think that's Sam seeing a vision of Nathan on the island.
Okay, so you saw him see a vision all the way up until when that kid turns around and it's a different kid. Paul, are you saying that? Or are you saying it was a mix of that real kid running around plus visions?
Yeah, I think it was, because we know that he was prone to the episodes.
Okay.
And
right.
And the way that the kid had the drawings, I think he was definitely leaving some, you know, the sacrifices hither and yon around the island.
Yeah.
Or I would say maybe it's the real kid on the island, but Sam is putting his dead son's like face and look on him. But the fact that he doesn't change his clothes, but now he is wearing different clothes after all this time, that's the fact that he was still wearing the same outfit at the end of autumn that he wore every time we saw him appear from afar in summer really hammered home the idea of a vision to me. Because then why wasn't that kid wearing the same clothes today?
I thought the kid transformed at the moment that Helen saw the kid. Like, Sam was always seeing him the same way. Just kind of like you were just saying, like how you could see someone and you think you know who that person is. And then they and you might even get close to them or call their name or whatever. And you tap them on the shoulder. And as they turn around towards you, you realize it's not the person you thought it was, and everything about them changes. All the things that you thought you knew you saw, it isn't them anymore. Like, I thought they were just doing that visually for us as the audience. Like, the whole time you only saw him from behind, you were seeing him from this, you know, from this fictitious Sam viewpoint. But that's not, that kid could have still been running around. He wasn't wearing that outfit or whatever. But then as he turned, Helen there represented all of us. And he, like, then that's why his clothes were, like, different and everything. Because we were seeing him for what it really was in front of us. Like, what I'm saying is that boy could have always been wearing different outfits the whole time. But Sam always saw.
That's what I'm saying. I'm willing to say that either it was an apparition of his son, or Sam was just seeing his son the way he remembered him on the body of this other kid.
Which I want to talk about that scene with you guys, because I was loving every minute of it. I mean, it was so like juicy and like filled with anticipation to watch her face millisecond by millisecond. I was like, oh my God, she knows it's not, this isn't going to be the boy. Like, I was so excited and like wrapped up into that moment. It was playing out in like the slowest slow-mo for me.
It was another great acting job, I think, from Naomi Harris of keeping her face straight and calm. But for me, it was the, you know, he would be 16. He's not even the right color. When she said the right color and his response was the hair, because both kids had the same, like, really kind of curly hair. I thought that was really funny. But I thought it was a great scene. I thought it was a really well, like, revealed scene.
That was, like, the kind of a separate scene that was, like, really amazing. I thought that that's when, like, all the beans were spilled, right? About the affair, about all of his antics, about the 23 minutes. Like, that was a separate scene. But when she's first coming in and Sam's like, do you know who this is? And he's all, yeah, yes, it's my mom. And even right at that second, I was like, holy shit. Sam has, like, brainwashed this kid. Like, oh.
Oh, man. You and I saw that completely different. You're just
oh,
how
really?
You said that. Just how you said that now is completely the opposite of his affectation when he says, I know who she is. That's my mom. He's completely flat. There's no my mom. There's none of that. No.
Oh, okay. I ignore my tone. I wasn't doing impersonation.
Well, no, but I think that's important, though, because wouldn't that be the response? Not, oh, you got older? Like, you haven't seen your mother in 10 years, and your response is, yes, that's my mother. You got old?
Now, what do you make of this? I thought Sam brainwashed this child, has maybe explained what she looks like, maybe even has pictures. I don't know what he has on him. And told all these tales to him of exactly what happened, things, what she said to him on the last day, you know, all the things. I figured he brainwashed the shit out of this kid.
I'll let Paul take a stab, but I have a different read on that.
Something about the kid doesn't actually seem like he's brainwashed as much as he's going along with it to me. The way that he had that final line to Helen when she was leaving the church after Shotgun Pete has his way with Larry and the other Droog. I choose to look at this story with some amount of a supernatural bent. So the idea that there is some of that, what you guys were talking about earlier in the podcast series of a genetic history or something built up in that kid, it would be weird for it to include some Nathan because, you know, that's not how genetics work. But if you decide to look at it with a supernatural bent, then yeah, it could.
So you think Nathan's spirit is inside him and out of his eyes he sees
no.
his mom?
I think it's Whoa. Possible that it's that kid is an embodiment of a lot of different things.
Oh, Wiggy. Okay.
Including some Nathan.
Not me, man.
But he seemed too calm, too cool. I don't think brainwashed. I think going
I don't think brainwashed either, but I have a much simpler take on it. I mean, Mrs. Martin explains that they switched the child. We never told him he was Nathan. And then she explains that it's the offspring of Colonel Sanders.
Yes, we know who he
right?
is. And,
yeah. Right, right, right. But yeah, so he was put there to be Nathan, like quote unquote Nathan.
No. No, he wasn't. That they never intended for him to think he was Nathan. He was there because he was Colonel Sanders' son. Colonel Sanders dies. The kid is totally without a parent. Sam sees him, claims he's Nathan, and they just don't correct him.
Don't you see, though, that Mrs. Martin wants him on the island. Mr. Martin wants him on the island. The cowboy wants Sam to stay on the island. He's only staying on the island because Nathan is alive. So I think they don't brainwash him. I think he is an OC in that kid. He's Colonel Sanders' offspring. He is just acting out what he's been told to act out. It was only the last episode that the cowboy got from Helen exactly her final words to her son. In this episode, the quote-unquote son is repeating those words back to Helen. I think this is all just a long con of the people who want Sam to stay on the island, just putting all of those pieces together. I think the kid is just an actor. I think it's like the Truman Show, where they all like play a role on the island. When they realize that he thought he was Nathan, they rolled with it, and they just made him Nathan.
Yeah, the cowboy was Team Sam at the end of the day.
I mean,
so
he was in the house with Mrs. Martin.
I totally agree with you guys on all that part. But I think that next part, the details of what happened and the details of what were said that day, was Sam feeding it to the kid. They said he spent every day, all day, talking to him about Nathan. I think that the Oceans, the Martins, didn't do that. You're right. They just ran with it. But I don't think the cowboy went off and told the little boy the secret word, and it was the Truman Show acting. I don't think it was any of that. I think Sam knows very well what happened that day before they headed out. I think he was standing right there when Helen yelled at the kid. And I think that he spent all of his time for all those months just feeding him, like, do you remember this? Do you remember when we did that? Do you remember this? Remember what mom said that? Like, I think it's all yickety. But I think it was Sam that poured the information into him.
So we have two versions of a rational explanation. And one, well, you know, he is the blood of the offshoot Charingtons, the ones that led the island to their current state of despair that made them go look for the original bloodline.
Right.
So maybe I just like that sort of stuff in terms of fantasy and all that kind of stuff. But I choose to see it that he is somehow this old soul that is very Ossian, kind of screwed up, and possibly embodying other consciousnesses from time to time.
Intriguing.
But on Ossian, I mean, I think any of those explanations is very possible.
I think it totally works.
Epona, creepy, sweet, or just another manipulation on Jess's part?
Well, I'll go all supernatural on you, and because
I mean, sure,
it could be some kind of reincarnation type issue. You know, maybe
she died within a day of the conception. So,
ooh,
yeah, that
old
was
Epona. Old Epona died. Yeah, when, you know,
yeah,
the
yeah,
night,
yeah,
right, the night after the conception. So
the new one's called Nupona.
Nupona.
It's like New York.
I want to call her Nupona. No, what was that thing? No, New York.
New York. Are you from New York?
What about you guys? Highly rational, just a creepster explanations?
To me, super manipulative. I think Jess revealed herself just to know how to pull the strings, and she knew she needed Jason and Larry on her side if she was going to have the real muscle. You know, in my head, the island kind of devolved in like the way like dodgeball teams go in grade school, where there's two captains and the one kid gets to pick all of the great kids, and then you have Sam and his like tag, you know, rag team of losers. Like, hell, you know, Jess ended up with like the all-star muscle on OC, and it was just a bunch of background artists on Sam's team.
Yeah, yeah, no part of me said sweet. I was like, right, ew,
right. This tent's full of old people and wimps.
Oh god,
they don't even got no guns. All the guns are on the bed inside
full
the house
of people. Oh my god, that was so funny.
I mean, everyone in the tent was a 5 and under line person. You know, they're not getting their SAG cards. Like,
they,
you know,
all felt like they were like, I'm here for the soup.
We were told there was going to be a religious service here in this tent today.
Right.
Will preacher be speaking? Like, Larry needed no motivation, I think, to be against Sam. But I think Jason, you know, needed a little more push, and I think naming the baby was that kind of push.
Larry just needed a beer, I think.
Larry, the fucking worst. I mean, through and through. I mean, when he puts them up at the Oyster hotel room where the baby was conceived, he's like, if Dej Walls can talk, eh?
Hey,
fucking Larry, you're the worst, bro. Don't do that.
When he said that was the absolute worst. He should have poked them both in the ribs like, me.
Well, he was doing like with like his eye and his elbow, kind of hey, 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 hey. You know, like, the fucking horse, Larry.
So gross.
He probably stole the boots.
Oh, he probably did.
Oh, but and my favorite scene of the episode was when Sam has his like one and only like really sack up moment, and he grabs the knife and he goes to town on Jason, and he says, "The dark is here."
Whoa.
One, I think that was awesome because it was the first time there was any kind of life in his eyeballs. Like, I feel like Sam is just kind of like a zombie for most of this episode, but in that one scene, he's like, "The dark is here," and he pulls out the knives and he goes to town on Jason, stabbing him. And it reminded me of the picture of the double knife wielding Sam in the church of Jude Law that we see back in the summer episodes. And this was like, he finally kind of became like what he was prophesized to become. And I thought it was a really, again, just another kind of full circle. There was a lot of things in this episode I thought that connected back to summer. And that was, I thought, a really great one.
That connection.
A very good connection there.
It's not only when he says the dark is here. That is probably the one most compelling thread that would make me want to see a second season. For 98% of the rest of it, I'm fine with where we're at.
Right.
It's the part where he says, the dark is here. But then he also says, after he comes out in the hall, I know what to do now.
Right.
Like you said, it's like the prophecy has unlocked who he's supposed to be.
Yeah, but we don't get to see it, right? So, like, I know what to do now. He takes him to the church just to give her the money and tell her to go. I mean, the door closing on his bloodied face, I thought was one of the best shots in the entire series.
Absolutely, yes.
I want to know what happened. What is Sam going to do? Is he going to war? Is he going to go take the tent people? I heard there was soup here. Is he going to go beat them in revolution?
Just here for the soup, everyone. Soup, please.
As fucked as it seems like it would be, we live in a state in our country right now. I don't mean like the state of Texas. I mean like the
current state of the union.
Right. Where I could highly believe that he would still have loyalists just based on that he is the rightful pecking order of the way that they do their succession.
Right.
Just for no
cowboy
other.
Is still alive, right? The cowboy is still alive. Janny is still alive at the end of the episodes. The Martins aren't, but
Janny just puts his hands over his eyes. Janny.
So funny. Oh my God. When he was like, you can't see me, like hands over his eyes. I laughed out loud.
He is so
cute. He's got that Drax invisibility.
Right. You can't see me.
Oh my God, you guys. Mike, were you going to say go through that whole thing about church and the money then? That's where the money is stashed in the altar. Didn't you think that, man, I thought that was kind of a big deal.
No, I thought it was crazy that he was using the church as his stash for the cash. Mm-hmm. I mean, this little church that I didn't really think we were going to get a lot of play on after Epona kills herself upon the altar ends up becoming kind of a center of activity on this island. Not only he has Stash's money there is this picture of him on the walls. I mean, he's the only identifiable person in all the pictures painted on the walls, and now here he is wielding the double knives. I mean, this is where he decides to make his stand with fake Nathan as the door closes and he's all bloody face. He shoots Larry and the other guy in the head, cold blood, like execution style, which again, I mean, I don't really, Larry's kind of a piece of shit, but that's kind of like a vicious, savage way to, you know, end someone. The church ends up being kind of like a huge deal. Were you surprised that that's why he went to the church? Not that the money was there, I mean, which I guess is surprising, but to tell Helen basically, like, take the girls, take the money and go, that's, you know, did that surprise you? Like, he made his choice, and his choice was not
that
the
he was going to stay
Helen.
Put. Oh.
Yeah. Did that surprise you that he, in the end, he did not choose Ellie, Tallulah, and Helen?
Oh, as that door closed, I absolutely did like a, oh my God, he's staying with them. Like, yeah, no, it was a complete surprise to me. But also, his very apparent descent into darkness, if you will, and insanity was so clear. There were so many moments. When you were talking about that moment of Ellie and Helen and the stone conversation, and then him in the background, he was making these Joker-esque faces behind her that were like disturbing beyond belief.
I gotta tell you, I feel like when he kills Jason with the bloodlust and, you know, the dark is here, and then he goes in the hallway with the shotgun, he says, I know what to do. I feel like that's the first lucid moment Sam has had since maybe he came to OC.
I agree with you.
I think it was the first time he was fully in control of his faculties, and that there was light in his eyes. He really looked to me, not brainwashed, but just someone who had just been beat down beyond anything until then. Like, he finally seemed alive again.
Well, Paul, talk about the lighting in that, because that was something that you made us watch at least two or three times, because you wanted to see exactly when the stabbing happened, and he said when the darkness was here. You kept wanting to look at the scene.
Yeah. The stylistic choice of the director for the last three episodes, you know, we spoke about in the first three episodes, they decided to go with this very, very shallow, like, depth of field where only scant amounts of the screen were ever in focus. And in this, and they played tricks with the color grading so that they emphasized different colors. And in these three, they used a depth of field that put a lot of stuff in focus most of the time. They used another effect to increase the backlighting wherever they were, so that it wrapped around the people in a very conspicuous sort of way. And the first time we watched it, I didn't take note to see if they allowed the lighting to have that effect on him when he said that the dark was here. And so when we watched it again, the light was wrapping around him as he was continually stabbing Jason. And I think that was done to, I think, emphasize that the contrast and the idea that the father is supposed to contain the darkness, but somehow find this balance so that he can rule OOC successfully on behalf of the world's needs. So when the dark was finally here and he's in the white suit and the bright white light is wrapping all around him, I think that's furthering this idea that you put forth a minute ago, Mike, about the prophecy coming to be. He is the one. He is the Paul Atreides. He is the Anakin Skywalker. He's the Neo. He is... But in order to do that, he's a little more Anakin Skywalker than he is Paul Atreides, I'm afraid. Right. Definitely. But, I mean, as far as Jason's concerned, that's all the high ground he needed.
That's true. I got to tell you, in the end, I actually ended up liking Jason. Jason really won me over during the autumn 12-hour event. So, a little sad to see Jason go.
Well, he seemed kind of resigned to it, though. I mean, a man advanced on him with a knife. He could have done anything else.
He was bigger than Sam, like thicker than Sam. He could have protected himself.
In a way, I mean, and the same way, like, you know, I guess in theory, Larry and his friend could have rushed Sam also. I feel almost like they respected the decisions that they saw Sam making there. Like, it's salt or soil or bloodlust. You know, like, that's like the third choice we really hadn't heard on the island. But something about the way Jason kind of was resigned to it, and that Larry gets on the floor and doesn't contest Sam in the shotgun, almost made me feel like, obviously, they probably didn't want it to happen, but almost like respected the fact that it was meant to be, not to use an Ocean, common phrase.
It was always meant
here on OC. So I think in a way it was kind of like, shit, maybe we backed the wrong horse a little bit in their final moments.
Do you remember in the third episode where I was asking you guys, if this is the Civil War, then where's the fighting? We got it. This is what it looks like.
You just had to keep your powder dry for 9 months, and then you finally got it. But
they use axes.
Oh, can we talk about that for a second?
How I thought of you, Caroline, right away, and how high you might have jumped when Mr. Martin kind of like sashays out. He's like, "Hey, boys, let's talk."
You got the old Dick Halloran in the chest there.
I thought of that same scene with old Dick Halloran. I was like, "No!" Like, oh my god, it was visceral. I absolutely jumped. I felt the thump in my own chest. I was like, "Oh my god!" Like. Yeah, but then I did think it was a little Scooby-Doo-esque, the way that they all scrambled and, like, no one really followed them. Like, there was actually, like a moment there when we were at the bottom of the stairs where it seemed like I saw their legs do that thing like Scooby-Doo where they cycle in place and no one's really going anywhere. Like, they could have caught up with anyone they wanted to catch up. Mrs. Martin was barely hauling any ass at all.
This was kind of like my question from earlier about Jess and her motivations. Like, they were clearly all acting on Jess's orders, right? And Jess could have had them all killed. She had the mother and son killed at the causeway, and that Tallulah had to watch. You know, they kill the Martins. They could have killed Cowboy, Sam, Helen, anytime they wanted. But they didn't. And you know, I had made a joke to myself. I think I even have it in my notes. You know, Helen and the girls, they go into the guard shack right across the water. That doesn't seem like they get really far enough away from the Oceans. But maybe it was just the fact that they left the island in the end. Maybe that just really cares that they're not on the island anymore. That they didn't need to be dead. They just needed to be gone.
I think that feels right.
Yep.
That feels right. Like, you know. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. That whole feel.
Mr. Martin seemed very squirrely, even for Mr. Martin, as he kind of like walked out there, almost like he was like waiting for the moment to come. Like he knew when, like him and Mrs. Martin, their final conversation was almost a goodbye. I don't think either of them expected him to return, and he didn't, obviously.
He was like, a way out, finally.
No. Yeah, don't fuck it up, shithead. You know, I mean, what loving words to be your final words to your spouse. But I mean, I guess he did return, but he had an axe in his chest when he came back in. But yeah, he kind of like kind of heads out. Like if you watch that scene again, he kind of like slaps his hands together. He's like, "All right, boys." and then there's like an axe in his chest. I don't know. It was kind of funny, but it was also kind of horribly gruesome too. Are you surprised that the Martins did not make it out of here? Neither of them made it out alive.
I was going to ask you about that with your collection of historical, biblical, and pop cultural storytelling that you've seen. Have you come across a story where people, a couple in particular, is stuck in the, they insert themselves in the middle of this power struggle in such a way that they're like on both sides throughout the story. And then finally the person that wins is like, fuck you both. You're both gone. I can't exactly. Something about it does feel familiar, but I don't know from where.
But I feel like Mrs. Barton, I think once Sam, you know, kind of takes his place on the pier, I feel like Miss Martin comes full circle to her husband's side. So I don't think they're actually, I think they're only on opposite sides through the first 2.5 episodes of the series. Then I think they're actually united front, you know, backing Sam. I mean, remember, it's Mrs. Martin who is all, we're not leaving this house. Sam can't leave this house, you know, making their stand in the big house, which doesn't actually end up lasting very long, the stand.
Is it possible that Jess knew that pretty much Mrs. Martin, if there was any voice coming from the big house, it mm-hmm. was hers during Sam's reign? And that, more than anything, is made put her head in the trough.
Guys, I'm coming from a completely different point of view. Mr. and Mrs. Martin were her captor. She was being held hostage in the oyster in order to be used as bait to get impregnated by Sam.
Totally overlooking that, but that's...
She was their prisoner.
They were complicit with her.
Beyond complicit. They put her in the bed. They made her do the things
they...
They
orchestrated this whole fuck-up from the beginning.
Yeah.
So from the Nathan Goldhan part.
If you look at Jess's... Well, just singularly Jess is all I'm going to try to submit for them right at the second. But you're right. The bigger picture, they absolutely were. But if you're just a woman who is being played as a pawn this whole time... Her husband sent her to the Martins. The Martins held her captive, impregnated her, monitored her, and were like all up in her veg this whole fucking time. So if you were going to kill two people, I'm killing the two people who didn't let me fucking just leave.
But I would say definitely the beginning part of that, the one night stand and all that, I would definitely say that was part of the... She was a pawn to get Sam to stay on the island. You know, we're going to throw your dead kid at you. We're gonna throw this woman at you, you know, and all this kind of stuff to get him to stay, to lure him there. But everything in the winter section seemed that the Martins did not want her on the island. Remember Miss Martin saying, like, I told her to get off the island. I don't want her on this island. It's foolhardy for her to be on the island. And she's using the safety of the baby and the pregnancy, but you got the distinct impression that she does not want her on the island.
Yeah, and I'm just saying damage done. I mean, you don't get to be like, I held you captive and I got you raped and impregnated, but I told you to get going. Like, that doesn't go.
No, for sure. But I think Paul's right, though, that the voice coming from the big house was Miss Martin's. She shows up, you know, the first thing she's saying is, Jess has had the baby, she's had a daughter, that represents a direct challenge to your, and she's starting to say authority, and then she gets cut off by Sam and Helen. That, I mean, she's being consigliere here. She's like, you know, listen, a child has been born, that child is a fucking problem for you. A direct challenge to your authority? That's how you're talking about the new Pona?
Nice.
Thank you. I think Mrs. Martin had to go. And when Jess says, you're all safe here, we're all friends again, you know that doesn't apply to you, right? I fucking laughed out loud so hard, but it was so savage, but it made me smile wide. And because Miss Martin's like, yeah, I totally get it. And she's like, do it, cunt. You know, and you know, she's all just badasses to the end. They all have their roles to play, and they all march to their end, like, without fail or blinking.
Was there significance to drowning her?
I wanted to ask you, Mike, because I was trying to remember. We had the different things that had to happen, right? It was like a drowning, a hanging.
Isis was the hanging. There was a death by fire and a sacrifice by drowning.
Okay.
And we never really had a good drowning one.
So that's right. Yeah.
I mean, if you got a shot good enough to knock somebody out in 1 second, you probably got enough to kill them, you know? So the drowning seemed purposeful.
Rites and rituals, man. It's how you invest people.
That's how I saw it. I was like, oh shit, we're going through the drowning part.
And I mean, listen, she doesn't fight. She's like, get on with it, we cunt. And like, yeah, they're all just resigned. They know how it goes. You live, you die. You play the Game of Thrones, you die.
But that's a sacrifice to Isis, right? That's what that's.
Well,
what...
Isis wasn't the drowning god, but it was a sacrifice to the trinity of Isis that Jess had described on the beach. Okay. But there were three gods. It was two gods that began with a T. One demanded sacrifice by fire. Isis demanded sacrifice by hanging. The other god with a T demanded sacrifice by drowning.
Like teases. Did we miss? Beezus.
Teases, Beezus, and Isis. Okay, but did we miss any? I was trying to remember if any other death in this last episode would have fulfilled any of those other parts. Like, I was trying to think, was there fire? Was there?
Well, they set the big house on fire.
Which, in theory, Mr. Martin was inside, so he'd have been burned, right? Was there anybody else that, I mean, can we remember, was there a last,
quote-unquote, sacrifice? Let's see, there was a knifing, a hammering, an axing, a
there
drowning.
There were several stabbings.
And I think, didn't he decapitate Mr. Martin?
I think...
Well, he comes down with a strike, so God knows what he actually does to him. He puts the bears in his chest, and then the camera cuts away.
But did you guys take that as decapitation? I did.
I took it as a pretty decisive blow, for sure. I mean, he was going to die with a wound that big in his chest like that. It was just going to take a while.
Right over his heart.
Yeah. Not even a while. So, maybe a minute. But
So Tyrannus demanded the sacrifices by drowning. Tutates demanded the sacrifice by fire. That's who we thought Goltan was. And Isis demanded the sacrifices by hanging, which is what we had chucked Epona up to trying to satisfy.
Goltan might count.
So if it's Goltan...
We never had a good drowning sacrifice, remember? Because I thought it was going to be Jason because of the tent revival, where they're like, we'll drown him till he's clean, we'll drown him till he's clean. But we never actually got a good drowning.
Okay,
Caroline, I think, had put forth maybe it was Nathan, but we learned tonight Nathan was actually not drowned. He was killed by Goltan. So we did not have a good drowning.
Did we know, though, guys? Was that a... Then that was the kind of the completion of the sacrifice...
The sacrifice
the
trinity.
Three. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
So then
I think
that should set things.
I mean, yeah, it should make the gods happy for sure. When you combine that with a strong mother and a new baby to
you
to
think like the gods see like the Goltan burning and they're just like waiting around, tapping their godly toes, like, when are they going to get on with it already? We can't wait around forever for these goddamn sacrifices.
I don't think time works the same way.
Yeah,
in
9 months to
God
a god
world.
Is probably just a blink of an eye. You know?
I don't think they care what we're up to. We're just the highlights.
They're just fucking mortals and stuff. Like, they're just getting their thing.
The way I understand godlihood, it's a very impatient kind of role.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's why the island is sick. I mean, the gods weren't like, we'll give you an extension. We're going to give you a 9-month extension. But they're like, yeah, we'll give you a 9-month extension, but we're going to make your island sick as fuck, you know, and nothing is going to go right. Your festival is going to be a flop and because of COVID-19, you know, so.
That's funny.
If you guys are ready to move on, I think the only other thing I really wanted to talk about was just the symbology of Helen is the third character that goes out into the water. Right, we saw Sam do it, and Jess carries her back. So carries him, like swims him back. Jess goes out; her pregnant self waddles out, and Helen brings her back. Helen goes out into the water, drags a rowboat carrying two kids, and swims all the way across the channel. What does that symbolize? That Helen was free to leave the island in a way that Sam and Jess were not. That Helen was, in the end, the internally stronger of the three. Or at least more devoted to her daughters, maybe? I don't know.
It seemed so. I had like a flash of when we were doing the practice parade and the one boy had it tied around his waist the same exact way that Helen did to drag the rowboat. Now, I know that plays out different in the festival, but she just had that tie around her waist the exact same way. And when I looked up, I was like, oh my God, that's like exactly how that teenage boy was pulling it. Remember, not in the real festival, but in the practice festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, ooh.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to how Sam has the boat tied around himself when he goes through the Stations of the Cross, which was in the middle section of Autumn. It wasn't tied as nicely. It was more like wrapped around him and kind of looped. Like,
so
she
what
had
if it's
knot,
almost but... like a rebirth kind of experience where like he did drag the boat out there to essentially climb up onto that what would we call it? The tower or whatever, the pillar, and stand up there, right? Well, okay, so then what's the part where he's pulling the boat with a rope?
He was pulled across the island. It was the OC version of Jesus carrying the cross from where he was given it to Mount Calvary.
So then how could if that scene looks so similar, how could that be translated? How did it impact Helen? Like, was that Helen's trial to have to, you know, go through all the things she went through and tie that rope, you know, that was like her final part of the trial, like it was the final part of Sam's trial?
I think so, and I think there was, I think there's an importance that she is the one, we saw three people try it, and she's the only one to get through, and she comes out on the other side off of the island. You know, there's a lot of rebirth imagery associated with water and coming out of the water and all of that. So I think you're probably onto something with it. It represents a rebirth. Like, she's getting, like, a literal second chance at her life, which could have ended very easily on OC. But, you know, she's kind of been given this new chance to with the money, with her girls. She got everything she came for, right? She still has her girls, and she got the money, and she got off the island. You know, she's free now to start her new life. It's not like they're going to come calling for her, presumably.
And there's some sort of kind of story mechanical way that seems to remind me of the Lost Island a little bit. Just the idea that the island isn't done with you. So there's something that's going to bring you back, whether it's just these crazy tides or someone's going to drag you physically or something. It's not even highly explainable why those things happen. They just do. And the island is done for now, at least with Helen and the girls, and so they were allowed to go.
I like the island is done with you. It's almost like a Survivor thing. Like their tiki torch was snuffed out on the island. You can go now. Caroline.
Yes.
What is the third day about? What was this story about, do you think?
I maintain what we sort of figured out in the last episode and episode 5, where I really felt like there was this like journey of whatever your moment of regret was and coming to the island and having to basically sort it out. And in many ways, how Sam had said that there was something about grief that was so lonely that I think that you could say that the island maybe represents like your own personal trial area where you have to kind of sort out everything that happened and confront the people who wronged you or you wronged, however that works out. Because if you think about it, you know, Ellie's confronting Helen and Helen's confronting Sam and Jess is confronting Sam and everybody's like kind of like the airing of grievances, if you will. And basically at the end of the day, you know, those who can let go of the regret and the things that was wrong, the guilt, the grief, the everything, they get to leave the island and start a new life. And those that can't, they're still over there sorting their shit out with their fake son, you know? So that's what I'm going with. I think it's a big tale here. I think I said, use the word fable, but I really felt like we're supposed to learn something from this and try to give ourselves a break, I guess, when it comes to things like grief. Like, go to where you need to go, sort it out, let it out, confront the people you need to confront, say sorry to those you need to say sorry, and then swim the fuck away and go back to starting a new life.
When it comes to figuring out what shows are about in very simple terms like that, I can often be too cloudy to come up with a coherent explanation. But I think it is about something about transformation through grief. Mrs. Martin told us early on that grief was something about holding on to it and kind of wallowing in it. And we saw that the Martins didn't survive this. Sam took his grief and transformed into something that we aren't going to see exactly, but it is something much more highly determined than we had seen before. We also saw Helen take the grief with Nathan that she had been treating with sort of the stoniness that she'd been accused of and turning into, well, not even turning into, just solidifying that she's the mother that her daughters need her to be, and actually Nathan needed her to be, even though she never really gave herself credit for that until the very end there. So I'm going to, I guess I just highly agree with just that little addendum, the way that I see it.
I mean, I think I'm on board with all of that. I think in the end, I think it's a meditation on grief, and the ways you choose to deal with it or not deal with it can either literally swallow you alive or trap you in this like purgatory or can set you free. you know, where you can see the clean blue-white shirt and, you know, you can be at peace with it. Yeah, I think where everyone winds up is a reflection of how they have managed their grief at the end of the story.
I agree. Like, where they got to, almost. Like, if you look at where every single person sort of ended, it sort of explains to you what stage of grief they made it to, I guess. Like, who's still wallowing, who's through it, who tried a path that didn't work. And I like your part about when you were saying that Sam tried to swim away, but he couldn't get away, and Jess tried to swim away, but couldn't get away, and Helen was the only way. Like, I think that is like a really nice visual of who successfully got away from the grief and healed and was able to move on.
Right. I mean, Helen literally, we literally see her on the other side. She gets through it, the chasm that the water represents, and literally makes it through on the other side with her girls and a fucking bundle of cash. Can't beat that, man. That's a good day. If you have your kids cuddling with you and you're holding $40K, I'm pretty set. Like, that's a good deal to me. There are much worse ways to spend a day.
We've been trying to figure out what OC's role is in this, terms of being the, what was it, the heart of the world, soul of the world?
Soul of the world, the sixth soul.
Maybe the way that works out, though, is maybe it is just a reservoir for grief. And when things are going right, it's doing its job well. And it sucks for them, but the way that they seem to want to wallow in grief, the people that had to stay were either transformed into worse things, like Sam, or they seem to want to just, I don't know, something about grief, something about holding it, right?
Yeah. What if you think of it like a liver or like a filtration system? Like think about how it was all made by alcoholics. And like, think of the liver as like the filtration system, right? And like, that's the thing, like alcoholics like burn out their liver because they just like can't stop, right? What if you think of it as like this liver, this little annex to the side of London, the super busy city, right? That takes in all this toxicity and filters it somehow.
But it can be overtaxed.
It can be overtaxed. And also, like, if you get to the point where more people are coming and are not able to be filtered, if you will, you get sick. Like, you get that, you know, how like you get...
That's why you got to close the island?
Yeah, well, you get that...
Toxicity.
It's like bilirubin, right? Like the jaundice, like your skin turns yellow. That's like when you're not, your system's not being properly like filtered through,
and,
right?
And Jess is like the dialysis, right?
Well, I'm not sure yet. I'm unsure of how this all works out, but do you guys like the kind of like visual or like the concept of like the filtration and like somehow it does thrive on kind of sucking in? Because if you think about the idea of having like a wild festival where everyone's having like drugs and drinking and stuff like that, there is something to that if you do it on the island, it kind of like the toxicity stays, mm-hmm. and then you can go back and you're fine. But like all your craziness like stayed put, if you will.
What do you think, Mike?
Just to the very last thing you just said there, Caroline, I'll point to the cowboy who, in the end, I'm sad that we didn't get his backstory, but, you know, if we get a season two, maybe that's when we get the fact we learn that he really is an agent of another cult. But anyway, he says last week that he only comes to the island in the winter times, usually, just to replenish his soul. The idea that he comes to the island to cleanse himself, the purification, or his liver to be filtered. Listening to you guys talk reminded me of something said last week about the island being a battery for grief. That it takes on and it assumes outer grief, and that's what like the darkness is. The darkness meter gets filled up as the grief piles onto the island, and that hit me because right before Sam comes to, right, what we were talking about, the darkness is here. That scene, Helen shoves the Tallulah's knife into his chest and says, "You lost Nathan. This is on you. You need to do this now." That's really when Sam kind of begins to wake up, right? He kind of shuffles into the room, no real plan, knife at his side. But then within seconds, he's like fucking killing it, literally. And it's almost like he becomes the battery for Helen's grief. That maybe he really ends up being able to help free her and move on. That she's able to make it off of the island then. Like, her time is able to end on the island because she has really now, she came for the money, but she actually needed to do more while she was there. She needed to square up with Sam. And him realizing his purpose is part of that, maybe that release that he, you know, he gets the money, he gets them off the island, he sets them up and stuff. I don't know. I just thought there was some idea that like when she physically hands him the knife, and yeah, it's a transfer, almost like a transfer of her putting like all of the bad toxicity out of her system.
Well, he could make it right in terms of like one child's being held there and you know, being watched over by Jason. And it definitely did feel like some sort of, I was taking it like a, like this was his like punishment. Like this was like his, what is the right word? Like reconciliation type moment.
Penance.
You know? But yeah, basically where, you know, she's like, you're the one that has to do the penance for us to, for me and the girls to be able to move on. You have to assume the blame. And actually act out the penance for it.
And luckily had to do it in order to become who he thinks he's meant to become, or who the island thinks he's meant to become. So it was really mutually beneficial for him to do it, you know?
Yeah, so. That makes total sense to me. That makes sense. Was there any last things that you guys felt like were unanswered questions, or like you'd really like to see them pick up if there is a season two?
I had unanswered questions, but they're all kind of a silly variety. You know, we talked, I think they answered a bunch of questions. I gave a little list here, but we've talked about most of them. The only thing that really surprised me was learning that Nathan had been taken 10 years ago, that he would be 16.
Oh my gosh. I agree. Because didn't we all feel like, because
it was
not
that long ago.
Yeah. You know? And we even put that like Ellie was the oldest, Nathan was somehow in the middle, and that Tallulah was the youngest. That's somehow I always thought
Nathan was the youngest. Like, I really thought Nathan had been the baby, not Tallulah. So that was the big revelation tonight for me. You know, he was the oldest, not the youngest. Like,
isn't
I had always
that
thought.
So weird? That like, yeah, no, I agree with you. That was a shocking little bit of information, and I'm so glad that it like came to light. And it was so obvious then when Helen was like, he'd be a 16-year-old boy. I was like, holy God. Oh my God. Like, it was right. Like, I was all in. Those two scenes was like all in.
But part of stripping away all of Sam's lies, right? We finally have a reliable narrator comes onto the scene tonight, and Helen is like, you know, airing out all of the laundry for him and for us. Sam's been doing that bullshit with the one piece of clothing for 10 years. That's a long fucking time to be hanging on to that. Now you kind of understand where she's had enough with his grief.
What were some of the words you guys, what were some of the adjectives? Do you remember?
Operatic.
Because, operatic. Yeah, grief. I was like, whoa. I mean, she used some like amazing adjectives to describe this like long, drawn out.
Which seems harsh
scene.
If it's only 3 or 4 years, which is kind of the time frame I had in my head. 10 years, and I'm like, yeah, girl, you kind of got a point. Like, I kind of agree with you. That's a long time to put your family through that, because that's just ripping open a scab every year for a decade.
Well,
you
and
know?
He doesn't seem healed one bit. It's like it happened yesterday.
But he doesn't want to be, though, right? Isn't that the point?
Yes.
He doesn't want to be.
He hasn't
healed.
Moved
that's
on
why...
from the day after. Like we talked about, like, there was something about hanging on to not fully believing that he was dead. You could stay in that zone. And he so clearly stayed in that zone. I love the idea that OC could be the place that filters out the toxicity of the world, and that
it's
you do need to
world.
Go there and flush out all the negativity and all the yuckiness. And that's somehow how the actual place lives and survives. I think that there's so many stories that could be told. I think the fact that Tallulah, to your point, Paul, about the like maybe that boy had some Nathan mojo in him. If he was the one running around the whole island, putting out the little sacrifices, and Tallulah saw the little fish head with the squirrel and like wasn't weirded out, it made me like have this whole like thing in my head of like crisscrossing people of like.
I think just to pick up on where you were going with that. I mean, she picks up a fucking steak knife. Now, I get she's scared.
Oh, that was a butcher knife. That was a big old baddie.
Yeah, right. That's actually meant. I meant a butcher knife. How many 7, 8, 9 year old? I guess she's probably more like an 8 or 9
year
old.
Oh, how old?
Right?
She's seen the steaks.
No, wait.
I mean,
how old is she? No, wait. How old is she, Paul? You have
9.
To do...
But I'm 9.
But I'm 9.
I'm 9. But like to pick up a butcher knife and carry it around like it's like her whoopee. Like that's
she kept her head though.
Yeah, no, we said by the end of the entire thing, that girl Tallulah, our girl, right? Like, give her all the credit because she kept her head. She was smart. She was clever. She kept her eye on the fucking prize.
She wasn't fooled about what was at stake here. So a grown-up came at her with a knife.
Yes.
That was all she needed. There was no one else to trust except her mom, her sister. That was it.
You guys, I use movies and TV to help me think of clever things. Like, I've told Paul, if I have to get into a hotel room, I know I'm going to go get that thing that kills a cow in its head, and I'm going to put it against the lock and air pop it, because I know how to do that from TV and movies.
Right.
But also, if I have to hide under a bed, roll up like a burrito. So smart. Using that blanket, I never would have thought of that, because then it hides your clothes and people don't notice a human. They just see a blanket under the bed.
Well, you can also take a little nap, too.
No, she taught me a trick that I will use the rest of my life.
You guys are going to have to buy a second set of butcher knives. Before anything else, I want to give a big shout out to Nico Parker, who plays Ellie, and to Charlotte Mihel, who plays Tallulah, because those two girls, I think, for being such young actresses, I think did a fantastic job. I think Nico playing Ellie also in this episode in particular really did a lot of heavy emotional lifting and never once took me out of the story. It had me fully engrossed on the edge of my seat, believing everything those two were doing. So I just want to give a shout out to them. I mean, you expect that from Jude Law, you expect it from Naomi Harris, you expect it from Catherine Waterson, you know, and all the other adults here who are stat cast. But for these two young ladies just kind of kicking ass, I was very impressed by them.
I'm incredibly impressed with all of them. The young actress who played Kale,
Freya Allen,
loved her. I thought that every single one of our main players, honest to God, killed it. I mean, there are some moments where
the dark is here.
There are moments in a show when someone pronounces something in a weird way or says something in a weird way that it will make me cringe and I will think about it for forever. Okay.
A construct.
Yeah. Oh my God.
What were we watching?
It was like an ad and this man goes, it's a construct of the system. And I was like, he meant construct, right? why did he say it like that? It's so weird. The whole thing was just, it was such quality through and through, and especially down to those youngest actresses and to the writers. Amazing choices of both dialogue and the way that they played out. Specifically, I'm going to say female characters. They were all young female characters when we look back at it. The littles were all female, and none of them were weak. None of them were sitting crying, sucking their thumb in the corner. They were the heroines through and through.
Just badasses, one after another. It was really great to watch.
Freaking amazing. Congratulations to all of them for a great series.
Paul, I think we might have skipped over to you. And so before we go, I want to make sure, was there any big questions that you did not get answered that you if you could, you would have answered?
Or season two fodder?
Were there any questions that got answered that surprised you?
Like I mentioned before, the one most compelling dangling thread is, what does Sam do now that the dark is here? That is the one thing that I would want to know if there were a season two. Everything else I can live with chalking up to ghosts or some other more rational explanation or just not knowing. So overall, I think that they've made a very, very good single season of television here that I personally don't need to see a second season of, because I've seen where very good first seasons wind up sometimes with not very good second seasons, you know, or just things that don't live up. And, you know, there's mythology here that you can explore, but I don't need it myself. I know that's not exactly what you asked, but
I know, I think that's right. I mean, I'm sitting here at the end, and I feel like the only question that didn't get answered that's nagging at me is about Goltan, because we learned tonight, and I think it's the first fully true thing Mrs. Martin has ever said was when she said out for Helen. I actually think she's being straight there for once. I can't see where there's a lie in there, because she does not paint herself well or the Oceans well. So Goltan kills Nathan off of the island. How does the trailer get on the island? How does it get on fire? Like, what does all of that mean? Again, overall, I think they answered all the stuff that they needed to answer, or at least gave us the good discussion points for it. I don't need to see a season two. I think there are stories to tell, like Caroline said. But if not, I'm happy with the 18 hours of OC that we got.
And again, congratulations to cast, crew, creators for really trying something brand new with the 12-hour episode, and you know how many people were really sucked into that, the amount of people who said, I just can't look away, there's nothing even happening on screen for 10, 20, 30 minutes, but I just am so excited and hooked that I want to see what could possibly happen next. So what a creative and exciting type of series to watch during a time when we're getting, you know, some kind of humdrum TV out there, especially during this pandemic time. This was fascinating to watch and something that I think would compel me to want to go to OC myself and see, do I feel the power of OC? Like, am I going to like feel, it's like, would it feel weird if you walked on the beach and shit?
That quality of not feeling like you can look away is something that you find a lot with run-of-the-mill, solidly built entertainment, right? That's good. I mean, there's entertainment that you can look away from. You can check your phone. You can fold the laundry, whatever. There's that level. There's a level that you definitely need to watch. You need to invest in. But if it doesn't quite get to the point in a couple minutes, then you're going to go back to dicking around with your phone. And then there's another level where you are willing to sit for an hour to wait to see if the screen changes at all. And that's a totally different level that I've only seen people be able to keep their attention when they're looking at works of art rather than things that are pure entertainment. That may be a distinguishing level of The Third Day as opposed to a lot of other TV shows. Yes, there's artistry to them, but, you know, coming from that theater background, the way that they experimented with the autumn section, this leans, I think, heavier toward the art side than the strictly entertainment side.
I think I would call the entire venture avant-garde, especially for television. You know, this was a real art exhibit, these 18 hours of television that we've gotten here. I think it was a pretty original story, but I think it was delivered in maybe one of the most original ways I've ever seen. And, you know, I've watch a lot of television. And, you know, my entire life, 42 years, I'm watching a lot of television, and I can't really put my finger on anything I've ever seen quite like this, which is impressive.
Very impressive. I'm super looking forward to hopefully grabbing up some interviews with some people who are participating in this. We can get a little bit more info and some behind the scenes action on this.
The sect decoration in the big house was of particular interest.
Oh my gosh.
When Sam is having his baptism, yes. He wakes up and he's tripping, right? The beginning of episode three.
Yes.
There, remember he turns around and there's the pram to the side and the empty baby carriage, but there's a baby crying, right?
Yes.
Behind him, a figure, non-faced figure, rises up writhing behind him. Yeah, it looked like almost kind of like someone maybe wearing a sheet or some kind of like bodysuit with no face. That creature or character, whatever that thing was sitting in a chair.
Ew.
Was like propped up in a chair in the hallway.
Shut
when they were
up.
That sequence had a House of a Thousand Corpses vibe to it.
It had like Ripley's Believe It or Not on like a super budget.
But not. Yeah. But I'm super glad you described it that way because what do we all know about Ripley? He traveled the world and he collected all these artifacts, and that's exactly how I described it to Paul. I was like, this is like. Every plant in this place is like an individual species from like different places on the planet. There was a real like Noah's Ark vibe about it that was like every little thing in the whole world is in this house.
You can see just very briefly before they move it out of focus, but there's a kind of a Bruce Wayne's mansion wall of cultural masks. Mm-hmm. In behind Mrs. Martin in one of the scenes. You only get it for a flash, but that speaks to Caroline's points. That's the kind of thing that Bruce Wayne would put on the wall that says, I've been to everywhere. All these places that use these. I didn't just get these at Pier 1.
No, right. No, I thought it was fascinating. And additionally to that, I thought that the busts that were all around the house with the bags over their heads with then like a, like almost like a lei or, you know, like a decorative necklace that like held the bag in place around their necks. And then the, I think the feminine busts had like a veil that covered their entire face with like lace. So it was like all the busts, you couldn't actually see who they were. It like made you feel like they were probably the fathers or mothers or whatever of the island previous. I don't know. Super fascinating.
Right? There's a tradition in Judaism, right, during Shiva where you cover the mirrors because you can't see the reflection. It's interesting, the idea of covering the faces after they've passed, you know, so as being some kind of death ritual.
I just thought it was stock full. Like, I was so fascinated.
What did you think of the one bust in the downstairs that they pull in on? It almost looked like a Poseidon kind of face.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It seemed Olympian. It seemed that sort of
I thought Zeus time frame I was going with, but yeah, I felt what you're feeling.
Well, I think I went Poseidon because of the sea aspect of it. Yeah, but yes, something Olympian, Zeus or Poseidon, maybe Hades. But Poseidon came to mind, I think, because of their whole sea thing, but it could have easily been Zeus. But I thought that was an interesting thing because that wasn't something they've really ever touched on before. But I think it just lent an air to the, this is a house of collection of oddities from... You know, there's this idea of ley lines. There are certain parts of the world that are strong in, we would call it magic, but more enlightened people or mystics would call it some other kind of invisible energy that connects everything, you know, the fingers that kind of connect the world all together. This house looked like a collection of those kinds of places.
I didn't want to get too nerdy, but at a certain point, I assumed that OC was a nexus of ley lines. I just didn't want to bring it up prematurely.
Oh, my God. Premature ley lines. You know what we all think of that?
Well, remember a couple episodes ago, I had gone on this little journey about there are actually 8 souls of the world. And it's the idea that if you took a 3-dimensional cube and laid it out, there are 8 points on the earth that lay out across the earth. OC is not one of them. The nearest to it is in like Portugal to that area. But it's interesting, though, there are parts of the world that are considered like souls of the world, which doesn't exactly correspond with ley lines, but that entire mysticism of ley lines, like you have Ayers Rock is a popular one that people talk about in Australia, is a ley line. It's this nexus of, that's why they use it like in Lost, right? That's why he wants to go on the walkabout in Australia. It's this whole power of the ley lines kind of thing. This idea that there are parts in the world where the veil is thinner between this world and the other world or whatever it is. So it was just interesting. This house looked like a collection of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Not like they had just been to Chicago, but they had been to places of like, not that anything's wrong with Chicago, but just that they had been to significant places that
it's just as mysticism goes. You know, it's more of an Abe Froman's kind of thing.
Yeah. I saw Sausage King of Chicago bumper sticker in that room.
But also just from the production standpoint, I thought that house was amazing. And actually, you know, again, because I care about the production of things and the set decorator and all those kinds of things, my eyes were like, like I had like my little goggles on. I was like a little scientist staring at
the second
at
time
everything.
We watched it, I didn't look at the characters.
Neither did I. I just looked at everything behind them. Yeah. I was like, is that an orange tree? Wait, it could be kumquats. Like I kept like I was like I literally
definitely
said,
a citrus.
I literally said kumquats, which is super funny. But I was like, my eyes are like up against the screen. I just love it all. I just think the amount of care and thought that went into all of these different aspects of the show. Again, sound, you guys, music, the way that they used sound was just blew me away.
That's maybe what feeds people like me into that supernatural aspect. You know, the way that builds, you know, you don't hear those sounds in nature, but it'd be cool if you did. But then you'd also be like, oh no.
That's the thing. Here's the thing. Do you know how bad I want to go to OC? So freaking bad. Do you know how long I could stay there? About 30 seconds before I'm scared out of my mind and I'm going to run back across the coast. Like, because every little crinkle of the leaves, I'm going to be like, no.
Right. Is that a fish mask? Right.
Can I tell you, there are a lot of times in this episode where I thought to myself, oh, this is definitely going to happen, and then it didn't happen and something else happened. But that happened a lot in this episode more than any other. One thing I thought for sure was going to happen was that the causeway was going to open, like, was going to rise up, like, underneath Helen while she was swimming, and it was going to be like a whoop, and, like, they kind of, like, fall onto, like, the ground. I thought for sure, because the sky was dawning as she was swimming across the little channel, that the road would expose itself. I was fully prepared for all of a sudden her to be, like, pulling the rowboat on the ground kind of thing. It didn't happen, but I thought for sure it was going to. And I had this very, like, roadrunner, like, where he goes off the cliff and his feet go, like, ding, 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 before he falls. I thought for sure that would happen with the rowboat and her in the water, but it didn't happen.
Wild. You know, just the idea that you thought it was plausible and that you would have gone with it makes the show, like, that exciting.
Oh, for sure. I think that's it, guys. I think we have talked this one to death.
We actually have spent 3 days on this episode. Yes. This is the third day.
The third day of talking. The third day of podcasting.
It's actually gone through the dark to the light. We are into spring now. We are now starting the spring section of the show.
Ooh, there's a new father of the podcast. That's all.
I'm the mother of the podcast.
Praise her name.
I'm the dark. The dark is here.
Oh my God, I love it.
And I just have a fish mask and scissors.
You're going to snip off some sin right after this. I got to go snip some sin. We didn't
even talk about the crickets. We haven't heard crickets at all in winter. We have not one fucking cricket. And then did you see Helen turn around as all of the crickets all of a sudden came up on the soundtrack?
Yeah.
Made my skin crawl, because we have not. I didn't realize until that exact moment that we had not heard one cricket since she arrived in Ireland. And then all of a sudden it was like they had returned.
Yeah.
They had returned. Well,
maybe the Dark, you know, was living with Colonel Sanders. He dies. Mm-hmm. They go nuts. Then they disappear. Then Sam's like, you know what? The Dark's back. And
they're like, crickets are like, hell yeah. OC, y'all.
They're like, see you on OC, crickets. They have little signs that say OC or bust. Yeah.
On the London Action News that night, all of the crickets in London have disappeared.
They freaked
we've
the
tracked them.
Freak out.
We've tracked them to a small island in the Essex River Channel.
Oh my God, that's too funny. Well, guys, this is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Mike. Thank you for listening to the Third Day Podcast. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Pod Clubhouse Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And leave us 5 stars. It makes Apple like us, so the Dark doesn't have to come for you. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.
Pod Clubhouse.